Good morning.
Good morning.
I always like to do that chant because when I first heard it, I completely misunderstood it. And it seemed, oh my goodness, my words are this unsurpassed, penetrating wisdom that can't be possible. And it took me years to realize that it has nothing to do with me. The Dharma coming through all of us is the unsurpassed wisdom, and the difficulty is for us to meet it. It says, you know, to meet it is so rare, and yet it's arising in every moment. So we have all these opportunities to meet it, and most of them are just going by like cars on the freeway. So over the holidays, I had a chance. Usually I'm reading children's books because that's my work as a librarian, and so I don't get a lot of chance to read big kid books. And over the holidays, of course, I was a little on vacation, so I welcomed the opportunity to read adult novels and nonfiction. And a book had come out that I'd actually bought for my husband as a gift, because I walked into a bookstore and it was facing out, you know, instead of being on the spine, the title page, and it was brand new, and the title caught my eye. It said, "We can all do better." I thought, yes, we probably can. And then when I looked at it, I saw that it was the new book by Bill Bradley, who was a senator from Massachusetts for many years, and at one point was thought to be a real candidate for the presidency. Too wise to run, however, he realized that he would not actually be able to do the things that he wanted to do to make the world a better place, and so he started a nonprofit instead. And this book is very nonpartisan. He has good things to say and bad things to say about everybody who's out there in the political world. But what I really loved was that what he was talking about segued very much with what I was thinking about at that time in terms of practice with my Sangha and other Sanghas and my Dharma friends, which was, when you've been practicing for a long time, which most of you have, it sometimes gets a little hard to bring new life to our practice. There's sometimes when it's like, oh, well, ho-hum, here I am again, sitting on my cushion. And as one student said years ago, who went to a retreat, long retreat, she said, so there I was, the fourth or fifth day of practice, still saying, so what shall I think about in Zazen today? And then she said, oh, I guess I could just concentrate on my breath. But that's how lackadaisical we get sometimes in our practice. And so, especially at the beginning of a new year, there's a feeling of, okay, can I start over? Can I start new? Can I start fresh? Can I bring my beginner's mind to practice? And how can I continue to be vigilant about my practice? So in this book, We Can All Do Better, I saw some things that were very relevant, actually, to practice. And he starts out in the beginning with a statement of something that came from Lincoln. It says, these pages were largely inspired by a passage in Lincoln's second State of the Union address, in which he said, we can succeed only by concert. It is not, can any of us imagine better, but can we all do better? That is a question for us as a nation and for each of us individually. Can we all do better? The relevance of Lincoln's question to the fragility and inequality of our economy, the direction of our foreign policy, and the paralysis that afflicts our national dialogue is indisputable. The challenges we face require all of us to be at our best. Yet our fate as individuals, even at our best, is tied to the success of our national community. No one of us is an island, even in a country as big as America. Larger forces, a flood, a hurricane, a financial crash, can overwhelm us as individuals, but together we can prevail. So even though he's talking about the national community, to me, he's talking about Sangha. And in my own Sangha, and probably in yours, just even in the last 3 years, there have been huge events, people with terrible difficulties. 2 years ago, it was one of our Sangha members who had had a major stroke and was a single person with really no relatives to rely on. The Sangha jumped in and did everything that needed to be done, including for 3 weeks while she was having rehab in Vallejo, somebody driving to Vallejo every single day to be with her. Different somebodies, but somebody drove the 2 hour or hour and a half trip to Vallejo every day and then drove home. And then just recently, we had another member who just came home from the hospital on Friday, who had her entire large intestine removed and will be doing a colostomy bag the rest of her life. And again, the Sangha is jumping in. And again, this was a single person with no other resources. Individually, this person, both of these people, have been very helpful to other people at various times over the years. But now they needed their community, and the community was there. So he's talking, and Lincoln was talking, about that difference between what we can individually do, and then why is Sangha important? Why is community important? In Lincoln's day, people were still helping each other build barns. You couldn't do it by yourself. You couldn't hire someone to come and do it. They didn't have that kind of equipment. It took many, many people to lift the sides of the barn, to hoist up the crossbars for the roof. And so you relied on your neighbors. That became your community. But the more mobile we have become in this country, the less we even know our neighbors. There are many people who live right in my immediate neighborhood. I might see them on the street, but I might not know their name. That's crazy. Even 50 years ago, everyone knew the name of every neighbor on their street. So despite all of these wonderful pieces of technology that we have, which say that we're going to increase our communication with each other, actually what I see is we're becoming more and more separate. So Lincoln, all these years ago, said this. Bill Bradley is saying it now. I think it's what the Zen masters and the Buddha have been saying all along. There's that famous story of Ananda not really understanding about the importance of Sangha, and he goes, and Buddha talks to him about it a little bit, and he goes away, and he comes back, oh, yes, Master, I understand how that Sangha is one of the three jewels. And it's one of the important practices. The Buddha says, no. It is the practice. You can't do these other things without it. Anyway, I'm going along in this book when I come to chapter 5. And just the title alone, I went, hallelujah. Chapter 5 is called Celebrating Selflessness. Now, that's a word that I don't usually see outside of practice centers, being talked about, lectured about, written about. And here's a whole chapter. He says, there's a common conception that human beings are basically selfish. One major political party says that the state must limit the effects of this inherent selfishness through laws and government regulation. The other says that our inherent selfishness can be controlled through the functioning of the free market, which maximizes individual freedom and encourages the rational weighing of costs and benefits, making self-interest mutually advantageous and helping everyone in the long run. But what if each of these views proceeded from the wrong assumption that people are basically selfish? This is such an interesting idea. Because one of the things that I know my students struggle with is how to overcome that I-centered thinking without becoming totally other-centered. So we were just talking about this yesterday, about the difference between, you know, there are people who just give and give and give all the time, but it is very hard for them to receive. Then there are people who take, 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 and it is very hard for them to give. Neither of these ways is helpful. Well, sort of what he's saying here. Actually, what Buddhism is always talking about is, first of all, finding balance. Where is the middle way here? Can you give and receive with equal graciousness? And second of all, it is talking about the idea that there is no giver, no receiver, just the gift. So years ago, when my father died, I was actually at Tassajara at the time, and I had to come out. And he had died of a major heart attack, so it was like 5 minutes and it was over. And so it was a huge shock to me because he wasn't even sick when I went into Tassajara. But it was great because I'd had 6 weeks there of being very, you know, grounded. And I can guarantee you, if you know somebody's about to die, boy, having 6 weeks of major zazen, really good way to deal with it. But anyway, I came out, and my father used to like to go to this Greek deli a lot for business lunches. And so my mother decided that the way she would do the catering for the party after the memorial service was to ask this Greek deli to do the catering. So I was with her, and we went there, and she was ordering this, and she was ordering that. And the man behind the counter was the owner, and he loved my father. My father had gone in there so often, and they had laughed and joked. My mother, at the end, she gets out her wallet, and she's starting to, you know, write a check. And he says, Oh, no, this is our gift for Dewey. And my mother's like, oh, no, you can't. No, I would never. No, you must let us do this. This is our gift for Dewey. We loved him. And he would not take her money. Well, my mother held it together until we got outside, and then she burst into tears. I said, Mom, what's the matter? Well, I just shouldn't have let that man. He was supposed to pay for that day. I said, Mom, they loved our father too. This is their gift. This is their way of expressing how much they loved him. You have to let people do that. Well, but they shouldn't. I should. I said, no, you have to learn how to receive this time. My mother is so used to giving, very hard to receive. But you see, receiving someone's genuinely offered gift is a way of giving as well. You are giving someone that opportunity. So my feeling is, I'm with Bill Bradley. I think deep, deep down, in our original mind, there is no selfishness. There's nothing in the way. We give, we receive, we do what is in front of us to do. That's the other part of this. Causes and conditions are arising all the time. We can't do anything about them. We think we can, and we try to control it over here or shape it over there, and if only over here it was like this, and well, I really wish I didn't have to do that. But the fact is, causes and conditions arise. And then our work is to meet them completely. Just like, you know, an unsurpassed perfect dharma is rarely met with. So we meet it completely. So apparently in 2004, Bill Bradley was invited to do this radio show, which some of you might have heard, but I haven't. It's called American Voices. And this is a program where he describes, he says, through the words of Americans themselves, I hoped to present a new perspective on the potential for a government of, by, and for the people. Well, what he did was he started going all over the country interviewing people who were doing something selfless in their community. And so there was the example of this man who apparently had been helped years ago He was on a freeway and something had happened, and someone stopped and helped him with his car. And so ever after that, in Southern California, he's still doing it to this day, he drives around with a trunk full of car equipment. You know, jumper cables and, you know, extra batteries and tools and all that kind of thing. So one day he was driving on the freeway, and there was a family standing right behind their car on the side of the freeway. And he stopped, and it turned out that I've forgotten what was wrong with the car, but it was something he had to go and get a piece of equipment and come back to help them. But there was an overpass nearby, and he said, "I think you should go and stand over under the overpass." I think it was raining slightly. "Stay there. I will return." Well, it was a good thing that he told them to go there, because someone ran into the car. And by the time he returned, the car was on fire, and the people were safe over under the underpass. Had they been standing next to the car, they might be dead. And so he's telling this story, and Bill Bradley is sort of asking him, why? You know, why do you do this? He said, "Because someone did it for me. And now I'm passing that kindness on." So apparently, after many, many interviews that he had done, the executive of the show came to him and said, "Well, what are you going to do when you run out of these kinds of stories?" He laughed and he said, "It's never happened, and it won't, because there are millions of people out there just like the ones I've interviewed. When Americans are moved by something, poverty, homelessness, spousal abuse, families, failing schools, teenage pregnancy, absence of values, deteriorating environment, many of them are impelled to do something directly to change the situation for the better. When we hear stories about Americans who take selfless actions, we're reminded of what we can do if our heart is big enough and our determination is strong enough." So, can we all do better? Because I don't think this is just about Americans. I think this is about sentient beings. I think that we all have big enough hearts, that we all have that original big mind, and that one of the reasons that we find sitting so natural is that that is the place where our big mind shows up. So there's another writer out there who I also appreciate, you may have heard of, Wendell Berry, who is one of the premier essayists in this country and was also a student of Wallace Stegner, who was a professor at Stanford in writing and who wrote several wonderful novels, probably the most famous, The Angle of Repose.
Who has a bench dedicated to him upon the
bench. Ah, exactly. That's right, I'd forgotten about that. So he says, Wendell Berry says, "My teacher, Wallace Stegner, thought rightly that we Americans, by inclination at least, have been divided into two kinds, boomers and stickers. Boomers, he said, are those who pillage and run, who want to make a killing and end up on Easy Street, whereas stickers are those who settle and love the life they have made and the place they have made it in." Boomer names a kind of person and a kind of ambition that is the major theme so far of the history of the European races in this country. Sticker names a kind of person and also a desire that is so far a minor theme of that history, but a theme persistent enough to remain significant and to offer still a significant hope. The boomer is motivated by greed, the desire for money, property, and therefore power. Stickers, on the contrary, are motivated by affection. Such love for a place and its life that they want to preserve it and remain in it. I love that. Motivated by affection. So when we ask ourselves, all right, can we all do better? Can we fulfill our bodhisattva vow, saving all beings? Well, one way is to be motivated by affection. Affection causes us to take care of our world and all the beings in it, because affection is honoring interconnection. We all have a great deal of affection for Jikoji. And we would do anything to make sure that it continued as it has started, as not only a center for spiritual insight and growth, but also as this wild and beautiful land. So we donate our time, we donate money, we donate energy. We do what we can to, because we love this place. We are motivated by our affection for it. It's not because you have some idea of becoming the crystal Zendo. Right? you don't have ambitions of glory. You know, it's obviously very nice when a lot of people come, but that's not actually what you're doing here. What you're doing is you are preserving a center of spiritual growth and beauty. And that is coming from this place here and the original mind that is contained in that. So generosity, which is one of our paramitas, our perfections, is the end result of that affection. Because we love this place and we love our own centers and we love the various temples that not just our Buddhism but all Buddhism, because there's something there that we believe is very useful and helpful for the world community, we are generous. And that is the end of affection. Affection arises and generosity follows right after. That's our bodhisattva vow. It's not about affection just for those who care for us or our nearest and dearest, but it is affection for all beings and places. And so, of course, the difficult part of our practice is having affection for those people who are not interested in preserving this beauty and this wonder, or for people who actually actively oppose it. You know, to have affection for developers who would like to, you know, tear down every beautiful piece of property and put up buildings, that requires a lot of practice. To have affection for the member of your family that drives you crazy, that takes practice. But to do it is a very generous act. It is the act of a bodhisattva. In that affection and generosity, there's really no room for personal ambition or fame or fortune, the pillaging and running. And that's the greed, hatred, and delusion of the three poisons. They are antithetical to our aspiration for a peaceful existence. So, Wendell Berry goes on. He says, the term imagination, in what I take to be its truest sense, refers to a mental faculty that some people have used and thought about with the utmost seriousness. The sense of the verb to imagine contains the full richness of the verb to see. And when we talk about insight, this is the see that he's talking about, that inner sight. To imagine is to see most clearly, familiarly, and understandingly with the eyes, but also inwardly with the mind's eye. I will say from my own belief and experience that imagination thrives on contact, on tangible connection. In other words, you thrive on the contact you have in Jikoji. If you sent a fundraising letter to someone 3,000 miles away, they might send you $5 or $10. But it is very different once you have been here. your experience of this place, your experience of the Sangha, your experience of the teachers changes. Fundamentally, there's a personal and tangible connection now. He goes on. For humans to have a responsible relationship to the world, they must imagine their places in it. To have a place, to live and belong in a place, to live from a place without destroying it, we must imagine it. By imagination, we see it illuminated by its own unique character and by our love for it. By imagination, we recognize with sympathy the fellow members, human and non-human, with whom we share our place. By that local experience, we see the need to grant a sort of preemptive sympathy to all the fellow members, the neighbors with whom we share the world. As imagination enables sympathy, sympathy enables affection. And it is in affection that we find the possibility of a neighborly, kind, and conserving economy. So I know that Jikoji every now and then invites the neighbors to come and walk on the land. And this is to create this. This is to imagine that everyone around here eventually sees this land for what it is, something worthy of being preserved. That everyone who comes here to sit sees this practice as something worthy to conserve. So another way in which we can all do better is to exercise our imagination and use it to envision the future we want, not the down version of the future that sometimes I think is where we're headed. You know, I look at the news or I listen to it and I think, oh my goodness, how can we be doing this? Are we crazy? Do we not see, you know, if we just continue in this direction, what's going to happen? No, because most people do not have long-term vision. You know, governments come and go with every election. They're not interested in 25 or 30 years from now. They're interested in the 4 years they're in office. But we have the opportunity to use our imagination for our practice, for our immediate neighborly community, for the wider Sangha, for the world. This is one of those, if you build it, they will come. If you imagine the world you wish to have for your children and your children's children, even if you don't have children, I don't have any of my own, but I'm a teacher of young children. I graduate 20 kids every year. Well, so I've been there for 24 years. Do the math. I've already got over 400 children out there doing something. I want the world to be a wonderful place for them. I want them to experience this connection that I have been so fortunate to find in my life. So Barry says that to imagine contains that full richness of the verb to see. To imagine is to see most clearly, familiarly, and understandingly with the eyes, but also the mind's eye. And this is precisely what we are doing in Zazen. We are reflecting with our inner eye. And when we empty everything out, moment after moment, eventually we reach this place of just pure emptiness, of just being in this moment. And the interesting thing is, out of that place, what arises? Not selfishness, as far as I can tell. My experience, especially after a long session, I know you've noticed this. At the beginning of the session, everybody's, you know, kind of bouncy, and they're all bowing in their own way, and they're not really paying attention. And then as the day goes on, people calm down a little, and 3 days into it, what you realize is, everybody is sort of waiting, and when they come to their cushion, they're all bowing together. They're not trying to do this. It's not like synchronized swimming. It happens very naturally. We become attuned to each other. And then the little thing that I was upset with you about kind of drops away, and that conversation I was going to have with you and let you know how I felt kind of drops away. And it's not that I may not later want to talk to you, but the whole way I want to talk to you about it is changing. And by the end of the retreat, what I find for me anyway, what's actually arising, huge amounts of gratitude. Just gratitude for the simple fact that I can sit here in silence, that my body is doing the thing it's supposed to be doing. You know, it's a funny thing, I say this sometimes, I mean, be grateful for the fact that you can piss and you can pee and you can poo and all the other things that you have to do. Because like my friend who is having a colostomy bag, suddenly she's not going to be able to do some of those things, and it changes your life. And it seems a silly thing to be grateful for, but you know the alternative's not so great. Just to have a body that allows us to come and sit together here on Sunday morning, to have ears that can hear the blue jays chattering, and eyes that can see the sun coming through the clouds. Just every moment, there's a dharma for us to meet. So when we're in zazen, we're emptying out all those ideas and opinions and extra stuff that doesn't matter to get to the original self, in which there is no I there. It's just this place where we all exist together. To see most clearly is to be enlightened. That's it. In that place, we see everything exactly as it is. You know, Suzuki Roshi used to say it ungrammatically, things as it is. Most of the time, we're seeing things through all these filters that we've added through years and years. It's like a geological formation. The water's down here, and sandstone, and clay, and, you know, on and on and on. And we've got to dig through all that stuff to get to the water, to get to the source. That scene, when we say we really see something, what we're talking about is authenticity. That knowing, when you finally realize, yes, that's what I need to do. Or you suddenly understand some line from the Heart Sutra that never made sense. How often have you been reading one of the sutras and all of a sudden some word or line jumps off the page? You don't know exactly what it is you've understood, but it is like it just zings right to the hara. And it makes you want to stop. You don't want to keep chanting because you're trying to figure out what was that. But it doesn't matter. Zazen is always doing you. It looks like it's the other way around, but it's not. You aren't doing it. It's doing you. So there's an authenticity to this. But to see clearly in this way, we have to be paying attention. And unfortunately, what I'm realizing, and the more I think about paying attention, it's not really a question of what we're paying attention to as much as how we're paying attention to it. So years ago, in my first practice period at Tassajara, I was on the Doan Ryo, and the Doan Ryo was also responsible for being the head of serving the meals. And at one point, I'm sure you have it in your Orioki meal, when you do it formally, there's a person who carries around a little cloth. And this is after the meal has been served. In fact, it might even be, actually it's after the second serving. The person goes around with this little cloth, and it's folded up in a particular way, and you hold it, and you walk down in front of the tons by everyone, and if someone brings their hands to gassho, it means that they've spilled some little thing, like little pieces of rice, and rather than have them have to figure out what to do with it, you stop and you get the rice and you put it in your little bag and then you bow and then you go on. It was very civilized. So, first time I had to do this, Mel Weitzman was the teacher, and you start with the teacher, and so I had beautiful form, you know, I had my robes and I had my little towel all beautifully folded, and I walked all the way down the tan very mindfully with my feet, and I walked all the way down, and I got all the way to the other side. There were 60 people this time, 30 people on each side, so I'd walked by 30 people. Finally, I realized that the Eno, who's sitting in the chair, or the place opposite Mel, she's got her hands up, and she's kind of going like this, like, hello, and I see her, and I stop, and I turn, and I bow, and she leans forward, and she kind of goes, three people passed Mel. Somebody had had their hands up the whole time, and I had walked right by them. So I had been paying beautiful attention to my little clock, you know, so, but I was filled with my pride of how beautifully I was holding this cloth, obviously, and was completely not paying attention to what it was for. Right? But this happens to us a lot. We get very concentrated on one thing, thinking we're being very mindful, when in fact we've forgotten the whole reason that we're trying to be mindful. So it's not just a question of what, it's a question of how. So being mindful, it's not something we can practice it, but really sitting on our cushion, walking meditation and paying attention to our feet, that's where we begin our mindfulness practice. And then we try to carry it out there, but we don't try in the sense of active. It's our intention. Right? We hold it as our intention. So, anyway, Barry goes on and says, remember, imagination enables sympathy. Okay, if I can put myself in your shoes, I might be able to feel a little bit about what you're feeling. And so sympathy, empathy, very close. And he says that that sympathy then enables affection. And it's affection that makes it possible to be neighborly and kind and have a conserving economy. In other words, the practice of simplicity. That when we take care of this connection that we have with all beings, then, you know, everything we just said in the Metta Sutta arises. Then we truly do want all beings to be happy. We want them to be safe. In so many parts of the world, people are not safe. We have such a luxury in this country. The last war we had on our own soil was the Civil War. So many countries are at war right now. Children and mothers, young boys being conscripted to carry AK-47s and shoot down whatever they see. It's horrifying. So our imagination allows us to step into someone else's life, even if we don't really care for that person very much. What I always try to remember is everyone is suffering, no matter what it looks like from the outside. And deep down, everyone wants to be loved. They may not act like it. It may not be what they're putting out there. That is because fear creates such good armor. But as long as people and places and these big issues like endangered species or global warming are abstract, it's hard to sympathize with them. I mean, we can think about that and think, well, isn't that terrible? But Barry says, remember, imagination thrives on contact. Tangible connection. As soon as your friend is the one who's in the hospital having, you know, an ileostomy or a colonectomy, then suddenly, you know, colostomy bags take out a whole new meaning, and you actually are helping this person take it off and empty it, and you're involved. I remember when my friend Hal had the stroke, when she was first in the ICU and then got moved to her first hospital bed before being sent to Vallejo. Again, there was someone with her almost 24/7. But then I looked around at all the other rooms. Many, many people there, and most of them never had a visitor other than the nurses. And in Vallejo, when we were sending so many people, one person a day, after a week, the rehab people said, "Who are all these people? I mean, are these just like your friends?" And she explained, "Well, yes, but they're also my meditation community." And they said, "If you have this kind of support when you go home, you will recover at least 95%. The average recovery is 50%. Personal, neighborly, tangible connection. That is what we can do better. That is what you do here when you welcome people into your community. You make them feel welcome. You make them feel that this is a place that they want to be, that this is an environment that they want to preserve. For humans to have a responsible relationship to the world, they must imagine their places in it. You have to imagine the world that you want to have, this safe, harmonious, kind world. And once you have that firmly in your mind, you step forward. You don't try to be kind. You don't try to be neighborly. It arises very naturally from your experience in Zazen.
Misha, you're speaking to the choir here.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem with speaking to Zen groups. I'm always speaking to the choir.
They've just done this. They've just done this for me.
I'm glad.
They know how.
I'm glad. Because that is what is necessary. And that is what is missing out in the world. My friend right now who just had the operation, she keeps saying, "I don't know how to thank you." You don't need to. Because someday, you're going to be doing this for me. It happens for each of us. Something happens. So to be able to receive now means that later you will be giving, or maybe you've already done your giving. To be able to give completely without attachment, to be able to receive completely without attachment. This is the fulfillment of our Bodhisattva vow. This is what we do for each other. This is what Zen masters have always known. This is that story of the 100-foot pole. The intellect can take you to the top of the 100-foot pole. You will start your practice because of the intellect and some desire you have. But it is your heart-mind that allows you to jump off and know that you will be held. You will be part of this very large and wonderful sangha.